Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you I've not yet had the honor of meeting, I'm John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. It's a great pleasure that I welcome you today on behalf of the institution and the Africa Growth Initiative to today's event, which is entitled The Role of Youth in Preserving Democracies in Times of Crisis, a Shared Goal of the United States and Africa. Now, before we begin, and on behalf of the Brookings Institution and the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative, I'd like to thank President Sirleaf's organization, Emerging Public Leaders, for helping us to coordinate today's event. And of course, we look forward to hearing from the President later, who will be joining us shortly. Today's topic could not be more timely. With the promise of the COVID vaccine rollouts, now multiple vaccines coming online, both America and Africa stand on the verge of dramatic change. Life as we knew it may be coming back. However, while American and African policymakers may be eager to put the events of the global pandemic in their rearview mirrors, it would be wise to consider the legacy of the work in the coming months, especially as it will impact their country's youths. Defined by the United Nations as people between the ages of 15 and 24, especially in America and Africa, youths have been at the forefront in inciting transformational changes and progress in their communities. Now, during the 2020 US presidential election, young voters had one of the highest turnout rates in the history of the United States. Young Africans have also been poised to lead social and democratic reform on the continent, as seen last year with the protests in Nigeria against police brutality, and with the youth activists in the Democratic Republic of Congo who were acquitted this past January. Collectively, American and African youth are standing up to and fighting against those transnational threats of our time: climate change, socioeconomic inequality, transnational criminal networks. They are standing for all of us. But still, without careful consideration of their political and local leaders, American and African youths are also most susceptible to being left behind. At the moment, many American youth are about to enter the economic state in this country, the likes of which we have not seen since the Great Recession, perhaps even the Great Depression. The African continent, where the median age is 18, the problem can be even more concerning. According to experts, in the next decade, the number of people in the African labor market will increase to 375 million. With more youths entering Africa's workforce each year than in the rest of the world combined, this growth needs to ensure that young Africans have access to critical services such as education, family planning, jobs, and all of these things become paramount as time passes. Indeed, to not harness the rapidly growing self-described youth bowl, and I would call it in a more positive sense, the youth surge, would be a disservice to Africa's capacity to be in charge of its future and to achieve the great promise of the African continent. Realizing this, policymakers and scholars must ask themselves, how can we uplift these young voices and create room for them during this time of renewal? And how do we do our part to ensure that the next generation, whether in the United States or in Africa, are able to continue to rise to the challenges of tomorrow and embrace the many opportunities ahead? With us today are several leaders whom I believe will very well have the answers to these problems. We should listen very carefully to their answers today. We're first deeply honored to have Her Excellency, the former President of Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The first female head of any state on the African continent, President Sirleaf notably led Liberia out of the 2014 to 2015 Ebola crisis. Also a recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize, she's been a longtime champion of youth and female empowerment. Today, she's the co-chair of the board of directors of the nonprofit Emerging Public Leaders. Madam President, it is such an honor to have you with us today. Joining her is Senator Chris Coons, representing his home state of Delaware. For over 10 years, he's become one of the leading foreign policy voices in Congress. Currently, he's both the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations, as as well as the Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Multilateral International Development, Multilateral Institutions, and International Economic, Energy, and Environmental Policy. He remains a longtime champion of strong U.S.-Africa relations and a dear friend of the Brookings Institution. Senator, thank you for engaging with us today, sir. And finally, we have New York Times correspondent Helene Cooper. In 2015, Helene was one of the recipients of the Pulitzer Prize for her international reporting, specifically on her work during the Ebola epidemic in Liberia. She's also the author of several books, including Madam President, The Extraordinary Story of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Helene, thank you for joining us today. But before I turn the floor over to Helene, who will be moderating today's event, a brief reminder that we're very much live and we're on the record. And should any of the audience members want to pose a question to the panelists, they can contact us at events@brookings.edu. That's events@brookings.edu. We're tweeting at Brookings Global with hashtag youth and democracy. So with that, let's turn the floor over to Helene. The floor is yours. And I wish you all a wonderful panel today. What a great grouping. Thank you.
Thank you very much, General Allen. It's a pleasure to be here with Madam President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and with Senator Chris Coons. It's not lost on me that none of the three of us fall in that classification of 15 to 25-year-old youth that you began with, General Allen. But I think we can give it a good college try anyway. Madam President, Senator Coons, congratulations to both of you. Madam President, to you for winning yet another Forbes Award on Influence. And Senator Coons, congratulations to you on getting your guy into the White House and assuming control of the Senate. So we are here to talk about democracy and young people, but first I need to take care of some current events house cleaning. Namely the coronavirus pandemic, not just because, Madam, you are on this panel looking at the WHO response, but also because the two of you actually have a history together, Madam President and Senator Coons, of moving quickly to deal with health pandemics. Senator Coons, the first time I ever talked to you was back in 2014, after you had just come back from a visit to Liberia in the middle of the Ebola pandemic there. And you told me, I still remember talking to you on the phone, you told me a story about Ellen Johnson Sirleaf that I found hugely striking. You said it was September 2014, you hadn't gone to Liberia yet, but Liberia was in the middle of the Ebola epidemic. People were literally dying on the streets. And Madam called you up. At the time, you were the chairman of the African Affairs Subcommittee in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Do the two of you remember that phone call?
I certainly do. And Madam President, I'll leave it to you to also comment. But I mean, I was not the only American that she was reaching out to, but it was an honor to have some very small role to play in helping persuade President Obama and his administration to make a bold step and to very actively respond. That conversation may have been earlier in the year than September. My trip to Monrovia and upcountry to Tapita, if I remember correctly, was actually in December. It was that late that we could get the Senate physician to, you know, give me permission to travel. But more than anything, Madam President was a remarkable, powerful, engaged leader, really fighting on behalf of her nation and the people of Liberia, showed incredible resiliency and heart and determination in coming through the Ebola pandemic. And the American people, I know, were grateful for the chance to support her efforts and to be partners in that very challenging journey through this tragic and difficult pandemic.
There's no way I could forget. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Even though I had talked to President Obama and he had said we'll do something, I knew if I didn't have someone who was going to drive it, who was going to take his positive response and turn it into action. And that's what Senator Coons could do. The fact that he's already mentioned the name of one of our rural cities because he came all the way here and he went. That's exceptional. I mean, he could have stayed right in the capital city and had some meetings and gone back. He went beyond that. And so we just remember him and the role he played and everything he's done since then to make sure that we all keep on track responding to these kinds of crises.
What I found really interesting talking to Senator Coons about that phone call, one of the things I thought was really interesting is he said, the two of you, when you talked on the phone before he came, the two of you didn't really know each other that well at that point, but you ended up praying together on the phone. And I found that to be really striking. Do you remember that?
I do. That's what's so exceptional. You know, I'm not normally the person who would, you know, end up praying, but it did call, though the circumstances called for prayers. And I'm glad that Senator Coon was also a praying person. So it was easy for us to do that.
And I'll just add something, if I could, Helene. We had actually met several times before that. Uh-huh. I had the blessing of traveling to Madam President's second inauguration mm-hmm. with Secretary Clinton. It was a truly memorable event. There were some very pressing security concerns. There were some very disaffected opponents of the president's who were wrestling with whether to recognize her election or not right up until the day. I got the chance to see two really powerful, capable, grounded leaders in Secretary Clinton and President Sirleaf. I was a very new senator at this point. I'd only been a senator for maybe a year. And to sit in the back and to listen and watch as they were navigating this very fraught and challenging moment was a tremendous experience for me. And Madam President had come and visited me in Washington. I actually have a framed picture of it right here in my office. She's the only head of state with whom I've taken a framed picture. And there's one in my office in Delaware and one in my office in Washington, because I was so taken with her dignity, her seriousness of purpose, her determination. And in that first meeting, she raised the issue of the Mount Coffee Dam. Whether or not the United States would make good on a decades-long partnership that had begun, you know, back in the 60s with its original construction. The headworks and the transmission lines had been destroyed in the Civil War. And as I remember it, Madam President was saying, you know, this would make a critical difference in making accessible electricity and power, not just for the immediate region, but the whole region, a three-country region. And the Millennium Challenge Compact, the Millennium Challenge Corporation played a critical role in getting the Mount Coffee Dam rehabilitated, open and running again. But that has taken almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that conversation with Madam President, the conversation about her interest in working with the United States and the importance of our re-engaging and being real partners, led me to help create the Development Finance Corporation, which is a new tool and a new resource that is going to help with development finance around the world, because it really bothered me. It really haunted me that we didn't have a good answer. She asked for a perfectly reasonable request for some assistance with development. And then I went to the Obama administration and was basically told, you know, we don't really do things like that at that scale anymore. You know, the United States has moved on. We do other things. And so I have had several conversations with Madam President that left significant impressions on me. What was so striking about that conversation during Ebola was that as a proud and accomplished and respected leader, I could hear in her voice when she called just that sense of desperation over urgency, just how out of control the pandemic was getting and just how urgent this was. And so that's what moved us to pray together, was this sense that this great nation and this proud and accomplished leader genuinely felt overwhelmed by the arc of it, by just how rapidly it was getting out of control and how many Liberians might well die if we didn't act and act decisively and act promptly. And I will always be grateful for the opportunity she gave me to play some small role in helping.
Well, that is the perfect segue then to what I wanted to ask you. Just one more question before we get to youth and democracy is just looking,
let me just say, mm-hmm. Senator, I left the dam in full operation. And it's working today with support from the Millennium Challenge account. I think you ought to know that, please.
Isn't that amazing? And I neglected to mention that, I apologize. That was the positive outcome, was that, you know, by the end of your term, it is now fully restored and functioning. And that is the exciting positive outcome.
So I wanted to ask you then, looking at Ebola and looking at lessons we can learn on the coronavirus today, since, Madam, you are head of this WHO panel that's been looking at the WHO response to the coronavirus pandemic. One of the things that the panel you chair with came out in the interim report was to say that Chinese authorities should have acted with much more urgency and much faster at the beginning of COVID. What about other governments around the world? And this is for both of you, because you both learned from you experienced the Ebola outbreak and saw what can happen when a government does move with sufficient urgency, as Liberia eventually did. How can you apply those lessons to how we've now around the world behave with COVID?
You know, Helen, I co-chair with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Helen Clark, the independent panel for pandemic preparedness and response. And what we're trying to do, on the instruction of the Director General of the World Health Organization, is to come up with a report. And it focuses on what happened. How did it happen that the world was so unprepared for a pandemic that has actually penetrated every country in the world in such serious way? What are the lessons? What can be done to ensure that the world is better prepared just in case there's another pandemic? That's our assignment. And we've done a lot to gather the information, the evidence, the data, to hold consultations, to open workshops, to get reports, to take the literature and the research that's been done and understand it and sift through it, get the evidence out of it. And we're now nearing the completion of a work, you know, that started several months ago. And in May, we're going to make a report to the World Health Assembly. And we hope we're going to be very bold, very clear and independent in reporting the findings and the truths, and also making strong recommendations about what needs to happen with the international system to ensure that countries are prepared, and an international system that also recognizes the role that needs to be played through national and regional systems so that everyone has systems, health systems, that are prepared to cope with any such virus or epidemic that may come again.
Thank you. If you want to leak the report early to a news organization, I'm here and willing to take it.
Just like a report.
All right, let's start with our topic. Else Brookings is going to kill me if I just spend the whole time asking the two of you about COVID. Senator Coons, I wanted to start with you because it seems as if, you know, I've covered for years, for decades, the United States goes around the world, you know, preaching to other countries about democracy. And, you know, all of a sudden, we're not looking necessarily that great, especially when you look at what happened on January 6th. So let's just start. I want to start with you with What message do the January 6th insurrection, does the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol have for American efforts to promote democracy globally, but also across sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, Hanine, January 6th was a tragic, a difficult, a challenging moment for American democracy. The U.S. Capitol, as our secular temple to democracy, is one of the best recognized symbols of democracy around the world. And as that assault was unfolding, and as we in the Senate were fleeing the chamber to go to a secure place, my son, who's a college student, texted me and said, Putin and Xi Jinping are having a very good day today. And what he meant implicitly was young people all over the world are watching this.
Yeah.
And they are concluding that the United States is not the sort of stable and safe and careful and dedicated and open democracy that we have long said that we are. And frankly, a lot of the predicate for that or the groundwork for that was an entire year spent focusing on unaddressed challenges of racial inequality and the protests that unfolded nationwide in cities and towns, large and small, all over our country in response to the brutal killing of George Floyd and then many other instances of police violence in which Black and brown men and women across our country were killed. Let me just say this first, that does demand of us that we tend healing our own democracy and that we attend to the hard work of hearing each other and respecting each other and building the connective tissue of democracy that has frayed under the leadership of our last president. And because of some deep divisions in our country, some of which go all the way back 400 years to before the founding of our formal nation as the United States, with the founding sin of slavery and racism that has eaten at and been a piece of who America and Americans are since this nation started. And that is work that I am confident President Biden and Vice President Harris are going to lead. But I also think it's important that on January 6th, we returned to the House and Senate chambers after security forces had cleared out the protesters who had stormed the Capitol. We resumed the work of certifying the election, and Republicans and Democrats together in the Senate chamber certified the election. President Trump and the mob that he incited were not successful in preventing the inauguration of President Biden. So although we had very difficult, violent day of protest, it did not ultimately deter our democracy from moving forward. We had a successful transfer of power to President Biden. Our unresolved challenge is the tens of millions of Americans who do not believe this election was legitimate, and the rising number of Americans who think violence is justified to achieve their political ends. As Madam President knows very, very well, healing the wounds of a civil war are exceptionally difficult. The United States went through a horrific, divisive, and bloody civil war from, you know, in 1861, 1865. I have an ancestor who served in that conflict. If we think the divisions in our country do not continue to live with us, we're kidding ourselves. And so as I have tried to be a proponent of democracy in visits to countries around the world, I've also tried to be transparent about the ways in which ours is not a perfect country. And one of the great things, one of the wonderful and challenging and inspiring things about the special relationship between the United States and Liberia and the robust communities of Liberians that exist in America and of Americans that exist in Liberia is that it is a part of that journey towards becoming a more perfect union by recognizing the unresolved and unaddressed inequalities in our nation that I think can still hold out promise for the future of democracy. Youth activists in Liberia, in the United States, and around the world are demanding action of a more seasoned generation of political leaders, not just on racial inequality, but on climate change, on opportunity and equity, on education, on public health. And I do think that the United States is continuing to make progress on those. But the incident of January 6th, which in some ways culminated a year of conflict and tension in our country, has to be addressed. And we have to renew our democracy if we're going to have any standing to promote and preach about democracy through the rest of the world.
Madam, do you think January 6th can be a teachable moment about democracy for African youths? How do you explain it to young people in Liberia?
I think there was a lot of surprise that something like that could happen in the United States, you know, the anchor for the world democracy. And I think a lot of people were saddened by this and the fact that it could have, you know, had it not been repulsed and actions that are now ongoing, could have had major effect on the democracy that we have had. Mm-hmm. We have taken so long and fought so hard to build. But I'm so glad that there's now a reset. And we can see that the pilot is now back. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, for both of you, but I would like to start with Madam, do you think you can make a reasonable argument to skeptics now about democracy? That as horrible as what happened on January 6th was here in the United States, the institutions actually held, and you can use that when you're talking about institution building across Africa?
I think the one lesson that I take from it is that at the end of the day, well-developed institutions make the difference. And no matter how persons or groups may try to put things off track, strong institutions will ensure that there's a counteraction and that things are put back on track. And so I think that's exactly what has happened in the United States.
Senator Coons, do you have any thoughts about the whole argument that you can make about American institutions actually holding? And beyond that, is it time for maybe a little bit of humility from American politicians when we're preaching to other countries about democracy now?
Yes. As I sifted through the texts and emails and messages I received from around the world, the day of January 6th and the days after, there were a number that were particularly pointed and in one or two cases pointed at me.
What was the worst one?
I'm not going to say it was the worst one, but some of the leadership of Zimbabwe, a country I have visited, and where, you know, we continue to have sanctions against the government and against several individuals. And, you know, we are trying to support and encourage a transition towards a robust democracy and accountability for actions that happened under the Mugabe government. You know, there was a very pointed public message about, you know, who the heck are you to lecture us about our democracy? That stuck, you know. I will tell you that, you know, folks in international settings like the United Nations, you know, the Chinese and Russians have long said, who are you to criticize our human rights record when you have challenges with your criminal justice system, racial equality with, right? But I don't think that we should be silent about the human rights violations in Xinjiang or the crushing of democracy in Hong Kong because we have significant unresolved challenges in our criminal justice system and of racial inequality. I remain more passionate than ever about a system where journalists hold elected officials accountable, where an independent judiciary defends and advances the Constitution, even in the face of a powerful executive who insists that he ought to be able to do whatever it is he wants, and where a legislature is a counterbalance to the executive, and where together they try to come up with a consensus about how to best meet the needs of the people. I do think humility is called for, given how challenged our nation has been in this past year to hear each other and respect each other and move forward. But in terms of believing that democracy is a better system than authoritarianism, I think the incidents of the last year and the ways in which human rights are being violated in Russia and China and dozens of other countries makes me, frankly, more passionate about the importance of a system of constitutional democratic governance, where journalists play a key role, where courts play a key role, and where elections and the steady and peaceful transition of power allow the people to be heard. I am more passionate about that than I've ever been.
Thank you. For Madam, I want you famously invented your own word back when you were a young woman starting in the Liberian government, when you came up with the word kleptocracy, which I actually literally think she totally made up, by the way, and accused the government of being filled with kleptocrats who were basically taking on the public dole. How do you respond to the young person who believes in democracy but says over and over, we don't see how democratic government works for us or serves us, and who thinks that the government is only a place to go and get money and that they need to wait their turn to benefit, you know, from the system? It's the whole our time to eat mentality.
You know, the majority of young people who are in public service are really good people. I mean, they do want to forge ahead. They do want to get into higher positions. Yes, they want to ensure that they make enough income to be able to meet their comforts and desires. But the majority that I've met, they are those who want to make a quick buck. You always find people like that. And those people, one have to find a way to deal with them, either through dialogue with them, through discussion, through civic education, and if necessary, through punishment or penalties. Mm-hmm. If it comes to that, if it's legal obstruction. But I still think, and I look at the emerging public a leaders network that I'm a part of. And I look at what happened even before that with those we started off what I call the president's young professional program and brought young people together to work together. Those who were abroad, mm-hmm. who came and were recruited and repatriated to come and serve their country, to have them paired with those from local universities and have them go to a meritorious selection and recruitment process, and the kinds of camaraderie that they form working in our civil service. If we did not have those young people that really were the anchor in trying to bring efficiency to public service at a time when most people in our public service were those who came from the war, young people who did not mm-hmm. have an education, child soldiers who mm-hmm. didn't have the knowledge. These were the ones that enabled us to make the progress that we made. And I dare say throughout today, of course, the pool of young people technically prepared to work in public service are much larger than governments have the capacity to be able to absorb them. And I think that's where our real challenge will lie. How do we ensure that we can meet their expectations? How can we make sure that the knowledge they've gained through so many years of prioritizing education, that we can get them the right kind of employment, the one that they can see as providing them the impetus and the chance for it?
I think you're freezing. I think Madam President is freezing up a little bit with the connection in Monrovia. So Senator Coons, let me ask you why we hopefully get her connection unfrozen. Just a quick question on this Biden administration summit on democracy that the president has talked about. What is actually, do you think that's even a good idea right now, given what has happened in America on democracy, but B, if so, you know, give me the sort of the pitch for this, and then who's going to be invited. But I'm less interested in who you're actually going to invite than how are we actually going to pivot, because this gets back to this whole humility thing again. Are we in any position to be holding a summit on democracy?
So Helene, first, if not us, who? So there are lots of other democracies around the world. Uh-huh. Who can and should talk about their democracies, their challenges, what transitions they've made. I'll remind you, Madam President won the Mo Ibrahim Prize for serving her two full terms under the Constitution and then retiring. Mm-hmm. President Issoufou of Niger was just awarded the Mo Ibrahim Prize. The United States has managed to have an orderly presidential transition without changing the Constitution, without election-related violence, without profound disorder for most of our history. But January 6th was a reminder that these moments of transition are very challenging. They're very fraught. Yeah. There's a huge amount of power that is passing from one group to another at a presidential inauguration. And so to your core question, first, I do think this is a good time for the democracies of the world to gather and to reflect about the ways in which democracy globally is on its back foot. Freedom House has said this is the 15th year in a row where authoritarianism is rising and where a number of our democratic partners and allies have used COVID to shrink civic space, to repress minority parties or journalists, or to make it harder for people to petition their government or participate in protests. And we've seen coups in several different countries around the world, from Mali to Burma. And the general trend is against democracy right now. And so what better time for us to approach the topic with a spirit of humility to confront what we have to do? And that's, so my suggestion is, before we host a conference, let's have some serious conversations here about how do we reinvest in and rejuvenate our democracy. I am moving bipartisan bills that are related to civics education in the United States and national service opportunities in the United States. We have five times as many young people seeking to serve our country through programs like AmeriCorps and VISTA and Peace Corps than we fund. And so I'm saying we should give young people more opportunities to gain skills, to gain a chance to go to college, to give back to their communities, through distributed nonprofit service opportunities in our country. I think if we do things like that, and if we approach this conference with that spirit of, we are going to learn from each other about how difficult democracy is, about how fragile it is, then I think it's a good thing. I think it's well worth investing in. One last little point, if I might, Helene. I did a lot of things in my several day trip to Liberia in December of 2014. But there's two things that really stick with me that are related to this topic you and Madam President were discussing about youth leadership and a younger generation. One is I met with the YALI Fellows, the Young African Leaders Initiative Fellows at the U.S. Embassy. This was a dozen young Liberians, all very promising, very capable young people, and who many of whom had been in college in the United States. But all of whom had been at college or university somewhere on the continent or in Europe or in the United States. And they had left those opportunities and focused on launching grassroots public health responses to the pandemic. And the things that they were doing, the initiative they were taking, as we went around this table on the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy and they were describing, I'm working on this, I'm working on this, on safe burial or on clean water or on contact tracing. It just was so inspiring to meet these incredible young Liberians taking responsibility, taking the initiative, leading the response. And I also one morning got to go to what was the daily sort of crisis update. And as I was driving over to it, I'm looking at the list of all the groups that are gonna be in the room, like five different UN agencies, like, 14 different ministries and like 10 different NGOs and four different US government entities. And I thought, this is gonna be a complete mess. I mean, no agenda, everybody yelling at everybody. I've been to crisis situations around the world where getting everyone on the same page and coordinating and communicating is a real challenge. particularly when you've got so many different entities from so many different. It was amazing. It began on time. It had a clear agenda. There was a decisive moderator, and they went through all the different groups and everybody had a specific thing that they were responsible for, and they stepped forward and they took responsibility for. And then after an hour, that group broke and went upstairs, and there was a whole room with tables that had, you know, signs on them, you know, contact tracing, safe burial practices, clean water, you know, testing and laboratory facilities. And sitting around these tables, you had folks from ministries of the Liberian government, UN agencies, different NGOs, and they were collaborating and communicating. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I wish the world could see this. Leadership matters. Yeah. Madam President's leadership, how she delegated a lot of this responsibility to very capable and inspiring young Liberians. This was not Americans running this meeting. It was Liberians running this meeting. And I came away thinking, you know, this is a tragic and challenging pandemic and a very difficult moment for this nation. But when you've got such promise in young people who are dedicated to giving back and to leading, then the future is going to be better. And in responding to natural disasters and crises here in the United States and in Liberia and in other countries, I see that. I see a younger generation that is excited and is eager to take their turn and is ready to step forward and to help lead and serve. And I think when you've got leadership that is willing to create opportunities and settings for that, there's no limit to how much we can do.
Well, the leadership part is clearly important. And that, you know, that's sort of, we're opening it up. We're opening it up now to questions from the audience, and I'm trying to sift through some of them. But for particularly for Madam President, then one of the questions we got from the audience is about young people and their ability to peacefully protest, both during a time of a pandemic, but also when you look at so many other countries, including the United States, but you see Nigeria and you see other places in Africa that tend to look at youth protests and brand these kids who are protesting as enemies of the state. Madam President, how do young people protest without ending up getting branded as such? One of the great things that you did in Liberia was to open up sort of the public discord. When you were president in Liberia, it was fine to protest. People could protest without getting thrown into jail or without getting, you know, attacked by the police. That was one of the debate in Liberia was so lively, and there was political discourse and people could have opposing opinions. That is often not the case. We saw flashes of that not being the case here in the United States last summer during the Black Lives Matter protests, and we've seen that in Nigeria. Madam, what do you say to young people about the whole idea of being able to allow their voices to be heard without ending up risking going to jail? What do you say to your other African leaders about where they are on this?
Peaceful protest is a fundamental principle of democracy. There's no question about that. But peaceful protest must move to another. It must move from protest to dialogue. That's the only way you find solutions. And I think leaders must also take the responsibility. In the midst of a protest, one must be able to engage the young people and get them to dialogue on what the issues of protest are all about, what are some of their grievances, what are some of their solutions. I think I had the occasion to just get out of a vehicle and just jump in the middle of a group of protesting university students that were attempting to riot. And I got on and just jumped into it with them and said, "Now, very well, if we're gonna protest, I'm gonna protest with you. Unless you're willing to come over to the office and let's sit around the table and talk." And that broke the protest up, but the protest turned into dialogue. And that live dialogue enabled us to understand some of what their issues were and to try to respond to it. So I think it's, you know, it's that. But I think also young people must find a way to create conditions for dialogue, to engage leaders on different aspects of the society, not just over the air or not just in a very contentious, you know, or critical way, as important as criticism is part again of democracy, and leaders must be willing to take that criticism when it comes, but take that criticism and then turn it into an opportunity to engage on both sides. Leaders must engage the young people, and young people must also provide the opportunities for that engagement and welcome it and identify the issues they want to discuss. So they can be, and there's so many ways that they can find collaborative action among their groups in the society to identify the areas for which there are differences or areas in which they have solutions and ideas that they can send to leaders. And so they're the way to open up the channels of communication. And that's what I think we all ought to focus on. But there will be protests, and there must be when the time calls for it. But there must be a way to move it so it doesn't become violent.
It's interesting. I remember you doing that. I've been with you many, many times when you did that. But I also remember you doing that when you got out of the car in West Point during the Ebola pandemic. And that's when, you know, things got very hairy. But I remember you going, there was a lot of give and take at that point. We have so many questions coming in from the audience. Some of them are really interesting. Let me read another one. Here, I'm just going to read out the question. I think this is more toward Madam President, but I think actually both of you should take this. Why do we allow former leaders to launder their images on youth and democracy after they leave office when they should have gotten it right while they were in office to begin with? It feels like lip service to me, as I have seen such happen in Nigeria so many times. Madam President?
Maybe the leaders when they leave office get bored. Looking for attention. No, I don't think that happens most of the time. I mean, there may be some leaders that may try to, once they leave, is to now talk about all the nice things that youths yeah. represent and all yeah. of that.
When they didn't do any of it while they were president.
And many do so when they're president too. And if they don't, I think we must find a way to call them to action. Youth must find a way to be able to, again, to call upon them and to engage them and to say, you know, just look at what we're doing, pay attention to us. And it does happen. And if in past leaders, you know, those who have left office ought not to leave their presence and contribution to the country. And so maybe if they err by trying to say nice things about young people, then young people should challenge them. Even though they're no longer president, they may not have no power to make changes in the policies as such, but they still have the responsibility to engage, the responsibility to contribute, the responsibility to be a part of what the nation is going through. And so we must all encourage that, I think.
Well, on that note, then, let me direct this one to Senator Coons. This is the perfect question for you. How can development partners help African countries whose leaders don't want to leave power and who are willing to use their armies against their citizens just to remain in power?
So I've had a number of difficult and challenging conversations with heads of state who were intent on staying, on changing the constitution or on breaking their promises to run again. And one of the challenges is to apply appropriate pressure to say you need to keep your promises to your people. You need to allow for a new generation of leaders. But to not act as, you know, we are the United States and we get to tell you and your country what to do. I mean, that's a balancing act because, you know, I mean, we have to be appropriately humble about the outcomes and the processes in other countries. But where a head of state has publicly said, I intend to leave, I am not going to challenge the Constitution, I am not going to extend my term, I think the democracy in our nation demand it. and then they change their mind and pursue re-election anyway, or where they, to the point of the question, misuse the security forces of their country to influence the outcome of the election, I think we have an obligation to press and press hard and to provide support for those who are contesting the election, to provide security and encouragement and support for democracy through the United States, through USAID and through our State Department. We provide funding for democracy and governance in countries all over the world, which mostly consists of supporting nonprofits that advocate for journalists or advocate for human rights advocates or for minority parties to help them stand up elections and to challenge elections if they're not free and fair. And that is deeply resented by some of the more authoritarian rulers all over the world, not just on the continent of Africa. There's a number of countries where we have very, very heated and very testy relations because someone who's been president for 40, 50, 60 years is tired of the United States calling them out and demanding free, fair, and open elections. But I think if we're going to have any credibility as a country that supports democracy, we need to continue to press for those who refuse to step down and those who just blatantly steal elections to be held to account and to either cut them off in terms of assistance or, as we do in many countries, only provide assistance directly to the people, not through the government. So, for example, in Zimbabwe, we have provided humanitarian food relief during terrible droughts when otherwise many of the people in Zimbabwe would be very hungry or die from hunger. Even as we have this ongoing tension and contest with Mugabe and now Mnangagwa, we have continued to provide financial support for food relief that is appropriate because the people shouldn't suffer just because their leadership is operating in a way that doesn't fully respect their constitution.
You know, Helen, I'm glad that Senator Coons said that because I think there is a perception sometimes that there is double standards and that some can get away with it without too much of a dialogue, maybe because they're resource endowed.
Yep.
And the fact that what happened in the United States in the last 4 years may also have served to undermine, you know, the emphasis on democracy and the commitment to democracy. So I think we now, you know, have to again reset and try to refix the standards to make sure that international standards apply everywhere by everyone.
It's such a tough, you know, it's such a tough thing, especially now when you, I mean, both striking that balance and when you look at what happened in the United States and the idea that we're not in the position to be telling anybody anything. We're starting to run out of time. I think we have like 2 minutes left. I want to ask this question of both of you and ask you to keep your answers short. But I think this is a question, the question as it came in is how can young people move beyond social media advocacy to reach out to political leaders? But the way I'd like you both to answer it, because you were president and you were senator, Senator Coons and Madam President, what if you're a young political person, somebody, an advocate, head of an NGO or something in Liberia or anywhere in the United States, what was the best way for this, you know, for young people to get to you, to get your ear when you were president, Madam President, or for you now, Senator Coons? What's the, is it to holler in the streets until make enough noise until you come down and engage with them? Or is it what, to write letters, what, tweet? I'll start with you, Madam President.
I think generally those who really send a letter that's substantive, that states what the issue is and they want a dialogue and they want a dialogue with a group of them to be able to discuss it. I don't think I would not, and I don't think most presidents would not respond to that. I think where a negative response comes is when someone, takes to the airwave and you degrade your country and you know, then I think it brings resistance on the part of leaders that says, if you're going to be critical, be positive. And even if you have to be harsh in your criticism, make sure you stand by your country. Make sure you show that you believe your country, you know, is the one that you're prepared to work for. You're prepared to be the activist for change. And I think most leaders will respond to that, and they will respond if young people do reach out to them in a positive way and ask for dialogue on certain issues. There are one or two that, you know, that may not. There'll always be somebody who feels that the power is in their hands and they don't have to listen to anybody. They don't have to pay attention to young people. But I think those are the few. I think the majority of leaders will listen, because if they don't listen, they know that they'll pay the price for that, because our countries are young. Mm. And the young people are demanding, and we're going to have to respond to those demands if we want to make sure that we keep our country safe and that we keep our development processes on course.
Thank you. It is 2 o'clock. Senator Coons, what's a quick way for your best advice for a young person who wants to reach out, young political aspirant who wants to reach out to you?
Show a promising solution. So for those who actually get engaged, roll up their sleeves and get hands-on and address a problem in their community or neighborhood, and then can come forward and say, I know we have a problem with getting safe, clean drinking water, getting affordable housing, getting reentry programs for those who've come out of prison, getting skills programs going. Here's an idea. Here's a demonstration. Here's a model. Mm-hmm. We know that we have more problems to solve than we have answers for. And one of the great blessings of youth is, you know, the energy and the vitality and the vision to say, we're not going to do it the way it's always been done. We might have a new solution. Those who come forward and say, I know you're trying your best, but honestly, patriotism consists of believing in and loving your country enough to criticize its shortcomings and then offer constructive solutions.
Absolutely.
And when a young person comes forward with an idea and says, mm-hmm. you may not have tried this, but here's how we could solve this problem. That's exciting. That's engaging. And that makes stop my day and say, I want to go visit this place where they're doing something great with children or childcare, with healthcare or outreach. And, you know, the last thing, Madam President has always kept an open and a youthful heart, that willingness to wade into the crowd and say, let's be in dialogue. If you're going to be a leader and stay a leader, you have to stay open-hearted about your willingness to hear ideas and to hear criticism. It has been such a blessing to be on with you, Madam President. I really appreciate everything you've done and everything you are doing. And Helene, thank you so much for moderating today.
This has been
well
fun.
Said, Senator. I'm still waiting for that invitation to Wilmington.
You are invited.
Okay. We'll set the time.
Please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, both of you. This was fun.